Coming up next on 94.7 WPBC LP Charlottesville, it's Apropos of Something. Co-hosted by Ellen Daniels and Nancy Lawrence, Apropos of Something welcomes experts, activists, and the marginalized from our community to discuss the latest policies affecting everyday people. Apropos of Something is brought to you by Table 44 in Stanton and Moxie Hair Lounge on Preston Avenue in Charlottesville. And now, here's Ellen.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Apropos of Something. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, Resistance Radio, and I always like to say Persistence Radio. Apropos of Something airs live every Saturday morning from 10 to 11, co-hosted by me, Ellen Daniels, in our Charlottesville studio, and Nancy Lawrence from our studio in New York City. We seek out the most interesting people we can find with a passion for social justice, political activism, and the arts, and we guarantee every show will be apropos of something. Today, we are fortunate. We have Don Gathers, prominent community activist. We're going to discuss upcoming elections for city council and the opening in the House of Delegates in the 57th District, Unity Days, an organization rewriting the Summer of Hate, and much more. We also have on the show Antoine Brinson, the impassioned and extraordinary chef and owner of Culinary Concepts, a five-week culinary boot camp that teaches life skills through the rigor of culinary training. But first, my good friend in New York. Nancy Lawrence, are you there?
Ellen, I'm here.
Fantastic.
And I guarantee, we guarantee something else, actually. I just want to bring this up. We guarantee the show is 100% unredacted. Come on. I mean...
Yes, that is so true.
Sharpie mark on anything we're going to be doing today, am I right?
Yes, and speaking of the news, you know I've been away on vacation happily, not paying attention to the news, but these are the top points that I've gathered in the last couple of weeks, and I want you to fill in the gaps in my knowledge, okay? So this is what I've learned. It is very sunny and hot in the Caribbean. The Kentucky Fried Chicken in St. Vincent is the most popular place to be on a Sunday evening, and the coconut water there is better than anything in the States. And also, on my way back, D.C. has the greatest ramen and a drink called Apropos.
Apropos of Inebriated. That's our next show. That's our show at noon or 11.
It was really great being away from all this news. And I do want to say Apropos is Aperol, raspberry tamarind, lemon, and Prosecco. It was delightful.
It does sound delightful. There's a word. Who has said delightful since January 20th, 2017. Few of them, and they're probably all where you just came from on your vacation.
The only other delightful things were our past 79 shows, which are available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. You can get them there. I wanted to mention that.
That sounds delightful. That sounds delightful, too. And speaking of delightful, I want you to approve my purchase order for, like, the woolen microphone I need up here in the New York office. We have yet to experience, like, more than 4 hours of spring.
Oh.
It's on back order up here.
I'm so sorry.
It's like chilly. I know.
I think my sunburn alone could give you some sunshine.
Oh, that does sound good.
Well, do you have anything else you wanted to mention before I get going?
Nothing as delightful as a vacation. No. Yeah. I think if we get through all this, I think Congress should also demand that we see... Wouldn't you like to see Trump's long-form birth certificate? I don't think he was born in America. I'm pretty sure he was born somewhere in the Kremlin.
Yes.
That's it. I'm done.
Okay.
I'm done talking about that grandpa.
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't think we uttered his word on this show, but we have his name.
No,
so
we have, yeah.
I wanted to welcome I wanted to welcome our first guest, Don Gathers. He is a prominent Charlottesville community activist and co-founder of Charlottesville Black Lives Matter. He's been a member of many committees, including the Charlottesville Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, and Public Spaces, and the Police Review Board. He's currently an organizer for the city's Public Housing Association of Residents, and he's on a committee for Unity Days, which will rewrite the Summer of Hate. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you very much, and good morning to you. Good morning, Nancy, in the New York studio.
Yeah. I wanted to talk about a little bit about the elections coming up. June 11th is primary, and general election is November 5th. And here in Charlottesville, I believe we're electing three city council members because Mike Signer, Wes Bellamy, and Kathy Galvin have stepped down. So the first pressing question, which I think you could resolve for us, is will you be running?
The answer to that, and I've come to find out that it's just as disappointing to others as it is to me, but no, I will not. There are those who would like for me to launch an independent bid once the health issues are completely cleared up, but I would not do that because I had made a commitment to run with Michael Payne on a ticket and a platform together, and I just don't think it would be fair or proper for me to come back and do something different.
What are your feelings about Michael Payne, since he is still in the race, obviously?
I am very much wholeheartedly and completely throwing my support behind Michael. God knows we certainly need an infusion of youth in the city council, but he brings so much more than just that. He is the one candidate among a field of many good candidates that actually walks the talk. He understands the housing issue much better than any of the other candidates that that I've come across or have had conversations with. He realizes the need. He realizes where we are as a community, and has a firm direction as to where we need to go.
So I wanted to outline who the candidates are, and then you can tell me if I've got this right. Michael Payne, Bob Fenwick, Brian Pinkston, Sina McGill, Lloyd Snook. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. So speaking of the housing issue.
Now,
go ahead.
Now, understand, those are the individuals seeking the Democratic nomination.
Okay.
You also have Mr. Bellamy Brown, who is running as an independent. John Hall and Paul Long are also running as independents.
Okay, thank you. I did not know that. So I know that you're very involved with Public Housing Association of Residents, that issue. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement there? And also, you know, I know that it's been a big issue, and that I just read recently in preparing today that the average rental in Charlottesville is $1,321 a month, which is just amazing. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, if there's any candidate running for anything that that touches remotely Charlottesville, and they're not willing to speak about the need and necessity for affordable housing, then you need to run from that campaign immediately. We constantly and consistently have to keep that in the forefront, the homelessness issue as well, and it's just the burning issue that, that we face and confront on a daily basis. The number that you just threw out of 1,300 a month, people need to realize folks were glorifying in the fact that UVA just recently raised their or announced that they were moving to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. I hope that people realize it still puts folks at under $32,000 a year. And that's just not going to be a living wage in this area. It's a wonderful feel-good moment and a good move made by them, and I hope that other employers will concede to do the same, but that's not the final and ultimate answer.
And getting, before you perhaps want to say more about the campaign itself, about UVA, do you think there are other things they could do, since obviously they're such a big employer of the city, to make it an easier place to live for its residents, for people that actually work at the university?
Absolutely. There's much that they can do and that they need to do. They are the largest employer in the area, and they need to make it possible that their employees and the people who work for them can actually live in the area that they work. The city needs to do more. We've got to bring all of these entities to the table. Because when you look at it, there's a huge tax base that leaves the city every day because people can't afford to live here. So people have to go out to Madison or to Greene or to Buckingham or to Fluvanna simply because they can't afford to live here, and that means that the taxes leave with them. So we've got to get all of these different entities to the table and try to figure out a solution so that we don't have to constantly raise the residents' taxes who do live here. I myself have faced an increase in the housing in the house assessment of $52,000 in 2 years, and that's with no structural upgrades to my home whatsoever. So we've got to come up with some better, more viable solutions to solve this problem.
And aside from Michael Payne, who I know is, you know, feels similarly sorry to you about the emphasis on housing. Are any of the other candidates up to that standard for you?
Senator McGill.
I know there are, you know, the five that Ellen mentioned, there are five candidates, at least on the Democratic ticket, that are running for those spots. Are any of them, aside from Michael Payne, as focused on housing the way you'd like them to be as he is?
Senator McGill speaks about it a lot. And again, we can't discount the independent candidates.
Sure.
They're just not up for a primary, if you will, in a couple of months. But many of them are singing from the same sheet of music. We just got to figure out what chorus that we want to put together and who actually may be one of the leaders of that chorus. Lloyd Snook brings a wealth of experience and understanding of what the city needs, and I'm sure that the business community and the downtown investors, if you will, are certainly supportive of him. As I mentioned, Cena has a good message. Mr. Brown, who is probably the last of the candidates who got into the race, also a local businessman, and he brings a wealth of knowledge about this area. So, I mean, Mr. Pinkston is a wonderful individual. Mr. Hall, Mr. Long, Mr. Fenwick, of course, has experience of being on council. So it's just a melting pot of people, if you will, and who people best feel comfortable with, I imagine, is who they need to migrate towards.
And what other issues do you think are important for the city council to focus on for the city of Charlottesville?
Education is another big component as to another big piece of the platform that people need to be focused on. We saw the scathing report that came out in the New York Times, and we need to address many of those issues. The ecology and the green piece, if you will, and I am willing to vote for most any candidate that can do something with the pollen right now.
I'm sorry.
No, it is funny. We're all laughing here.
At the end of that sentence.
We're laughing here.
Everyone's vehicle is the same putrid yellow color around here.
That is true.
No, I know it's serious. I'm sorry. I do apologize genuinely. What about, as diametrically opposed to that, what about the idea of paying more for first responders and, anyway, I'll start with that. What about paying more for first responders? What's your feeling on that?
First responders and teachers as well.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to do a better job of figuring out how to stop what the police chief described, as you will, as a mass migration of police officers leaving the city ranks. And again, we're losing good people for simplistic issues. You know, a take-home vehicle the pay rates as opposed to some of the surrounding counties. We've got to be able to figure that out. And it's the same thing with the educational system. We got to figure out how to keep our very best teachers so that we don't lose them to a surrounding county simply based on pay.
Yeah. Do you have any ideas on how to develop trust between the city and its cops, sir?
Transparency would be a great start. And I mean a complete and openness in a vehicle and a mechanism to provide that. The CRB, the Civilian Review Board, is a great start. I will say that some people just need to get out of the way and let that board function as independently and as properly as they can. There are many who don't want to see that board be successful for various reasons, but if it's done properly, it's an insurance company both for the police officers and for the citizens, because it will protect those officers who are doing things the right way, but will also expose those officers who are not doing things properly.
And speaking of that, you mentioned Unity Days to me. Can you tell us what that is?
That's a huge committee of people who have volunteered, if you will, and been put together to try to not rewrite the narrative, but unify the city after the events of A11 and A12, and really the entire Summer of Hate from 2017, where we actually control the narrative and let the community say what it is that they want and what they want this summer to look like. Not to try to forget what happened, because we'll certainly never forget what happened a couple of summers ago, but to bring to light some of the wonderful people that we actually do have here in the community.
So what will we see as a result of that, and what are some of the things that you're planning?
There are events that are planned, without giving too much away, but there are events that are planned for the months of May, the months of June, the months of July, and 4-day events that are planned for August, leading up to and including August 11th and 12th. And it will be totally driven by the city and by the citizens. The city government has taken control of the downtown park so that no one will be able to request or secure a permit. They will actually be in control of the parks, and part of the events will indeed take place in those very parks.
Mm-hmm. You know, those events on August 11th and 12th, I remember at the time people said, well, that's not really Charlottesville, that's not who we are. Did you at the time feel that was true? And also, do you feel it's gotten better or worse since then?
The events of August 11th and 12th, and really that entire summer, pulled the Band-Aid off of a very raw scab that existed here in this city. People say that wasn't Charlottesville. It was very much Charlottesville. Now, the biggest bulk of people who came in and produced the hatred were not from Charlottesville, but the real fact is that many of them are and still walk amongst us here today. So this was an underlying current that had been running through this town for quite some time. The division that was there prior to A11 and A12 still exists. This city, as much as I love it, is very much a bad episode of the haves and the have-nots. Either you're on one end of the spectrum or you're not. The biggest gap in disparity and wealth exists right here in the Charlottesville area.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved with the making of the film Charlottesville, Our Streets?
I was in the film. I wasn't necessarily involved in the making of it.
Okay.
Yes, I've been in that and several other documentaries about Charlottesville as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it was accurate, that portrayal?
For that weekend, for that day, very much of it. There are people who aren't happy with it because it somewhat, in many ways, gave a platform to the Nazis, to the evilness that came in here and descended on us on that weekend. But I don't think that you can tell the true story of what happened without actually giving them space to speak.
Were you there? Were you there at the, during the mayhem, the rioting?
Sadly, yes, ma'am, I was. It was a life-changing event, and you saw things that day that no one should see unless they're dropped into the hot zone in a war somewhere. There was all manner of just evilness. I describe it as watching the ninth gate of hell open, and just all of the demons coming pouring in.
Well, we're going to go to a hard break on that note. We'll come back and we'll talk a lot more with Don Gathers, community activist. We're talking about all the issues, or many of the issues, important to Charlottesville. Stick with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Apropos of Something. I'm here with my co-host in New York, Nancy Lawrence, and we have in the studio today Don Gathers, community activist, and Antoine Brinson coming up shortly, chef and owner of Culinary Concepts. You won't want to miss that interview as well. So I did have to go to a kind of an unfortunate break as we were talking about the gates of hell, but not to make light of it at all. But let's talk a little bit more about what's been happening since. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, right after that, Dave Matthews put together an incredible concert and just opened up the doors to Scott Stadium with some wonderful friends in the industry that were willing to come out and try to produce a feel-good moment that was very much needed for for the city after what we endured. But that didn't change what happened. That didn't erase the pain and the anguish that many people felt and still continue to feel. The trauma is very much still real. God bless the Wahoos men basketball team and their recent victory and being crowned NCAA champions. And again, it was just another feel-good moment. It helps us momentarily and gives us something positive to look at. But the issues that caused A11 and A12 still very much exist.
Are you one who does think that, or is concerned? It sounds like it. Sorry, I don't mean to fill in the blank, so I'm not. That thinks that Virginia winning the championship is going to now whitewash over the problems of racism and hatred and all the stuff that happened 2 years ago, let alone, as you said, it's not really news to you in the first place.
Absolutely not. And unless we can start to have those tough conversations where we actually talk about racism instead of race, unless we can move the needle towards and some positive issues and some positive point, we can't ever get to the underlying root as to what actually caused A11 and A12 and the hatred that was brought here. We've just got so much work to do, and we can't be deflected by these feel-good moments along the annals of time. We have very much become a blip on the racist history of this country, and we've got to figure out how to overcome that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the city has done enough to answer for how it let everyone down, and the complete breakdown of the police? And anyway, I'll just start with that. Do you think the city has answered for itself sufficiently in all this time?
Wow.
Is that bad?
Well,
okay.
The real fact is that when you look at it, the people who bore the brunt of payment for that weekend were men of color who directly lost their jobs because of it. When you look at the city manager, when you look at the police chief, the former police chief, Al Thomas, and of course, Maurice Jones, they lost, in essence, their jobs as a direct result, if you will, from the mishandling of A12. While others, non-people of color, were allowed to either move on to other jobs or retire and carry their pensions on with them, and that's just a microcosm of the problems that exist not only here but also throughout the country. I mean, when you got the dude in D.C. 46-1 who dared have the temerity to portray that day as fine, many fine people on both sides, and double down on that narrative, and it's just a slew of dog whistles that come out. I saw something earlier today that said something about we don't have a president. We have someone who sings racist poems to his following. I mean, it's just a sad state of affairs that we're in this country. So anyone who is progressive, anyone who is young and willing to listen, because if anyone needs an infusion of youth in this country, it's our Congress, our Senate, our State House, and while I'm there, I'll say that I am very much supportive of Sally Hudson in her bid for the seat in the 57th District in the House. I like what I'm seeing and hearing from Sally. She is a very much progressive candidate. What I like most about her is she's willing to listen.
That's great. I did want to ask you about that. She's running for the Democratic seat against Kathy Galvin, who stepped down, as I mentioned, from the city council to do that.
Well, she didn't step down. Her term is up this year.
Okay,
so
she's
not running.
She's not running again.
Right.
Yes, correct. Before we run out of time, I did want to ask you where your interest in social activism comes from and a little bit about your growing up.
Well, I'm the the last of six boys that my mother gave birth to. God bless her. God rest her soul. She just passed away a couple of weeks ago. I grew up in the Churchill section of Richmond, which was interesting and interesting times. I survived and lived through the onset of the crack epidemic. Richmond was one of the top drop-off places between Florida and New York. So there was an explosion of crime. At one point, Richmond, for a couple of years, was the murder capital of the country. And it was just interesting to be able to survive those times. Most of my life have been doing work involving helping people. I have a strong union background. My first real job as an adult, so to speak, was with the telephone company, and I was a union representative with them for some 17 years, I believe. So, and I worked, and that was with the Communication Workers of America. I've also worked several other unions throughout the years. So I've always had an interest in bettering the life of people. So social activism was just a natural fit.
Don, I know last summer you were part of that pilgrimage that went to the National Memorial, for Peace and Justice in Alabama. I was just wondering what that experience was like for you, and what made the most powerful impression or impressions.
Life-changing, and something that was very much needed for this this community. There were some 96 of us that went on that pilgrimage, and we just hit many of the civil rights historic civil rights sites between Charlottesville and our ultimate destination, which was Montgomery. So we went to Appomattox, we went to Danville, we went to Greensboro and to Charlotte, to Atlanta, to Selma, Montgomery, and also to to Selma, Alabama, and also to Montgomery. We got to walk the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the site of Bloody Sunday. I got to stand in the pulpit that that Dr. Martin Luther King preached from. So it was just a life altering and life changing event for many of us. And the goal was we were taking the soil from the site of the lynching of Mr. John Henry James out in Albemarle County to the Equal Justice Initiative Museum down in Montgomery. And that's an incredible place, and I encourage everyone who has the opportunity to go to please get there. There are soil samples from lynching sites all across the country, and we're hoping to bring the monument back here depicting his lynching sometime this spring and summer.
I know we've talk to some people also who were on that pilgrimage. It sounds amazing, and I think there may be plans to go back or to do another trip like that.
I think the plan right now is to actually go to pick up the monument to bring it back.
Okay, that makes sense. And just we've learned about the violence during that period, that we don't really learn as people, white people for sure, but people in general in schools. So it is good to hear the truth.
And that's a large black eye on the educational system, not just here, but across the country. We've got to teach the history as it exists, full and true.
Yeah, absolutely.
The House of Delegates, speaking of, I know there was a subcommittee that of eight white men that killed the bill that would allow local, to allow localities to decide what to do with those Confederate monuments. And I was wondering, in the short time we have left, what would you like to see done with the ones in Charlottesville?
I was a proponent, and since I actually chaired the BRC, it was my recommendation that we move them to McIntyre Park. I just think that that's the appropriate place for them because Mr. McIntyre deeded them to the city. And I just think we don't need to destroy them, but for those who want to actually go and relish them and adore them, that would be a more appropriate site.
Well, I wanted to thank you for being here, Don. It's been a long time coming, so thank you so much for being here and educating us. I hope you'll come back sometime.
Oh, my thanks to you, Ellen, and to Nancy, and to the station. You all truly are the progressive voice here in town. I love my brother Charles Lewis on his Sunday show. And thanks to Jeff. You all are doing remarkable work here.
Yes, Jeff Leonard. Thank you so much once again.
Thank you.
I hope you'll stick around for a picture.
Absolutely.
If you need to go, you're free to go. Okay. Nancy, with that, do you have a news of note?
I do. I have a voter-ish, yes, speaking of primaries and such. This one is in Tennessee. Tennessee wants to criminalize voter drives, if you can believe it, and why not. Tennessee Republicans are working to pass a Kafka-esque bill that will seriously limit organizers' ability to register new voters by imposing criminal and civil penalties. The goal is, of course, to intimidate groups from abandoning registration drives out of fear they're going to be fined or prosecuted. And first, what they want to do is insist that anyone that conducts registration drives has to take a training course from the Secretary of State. And so far, they've made it unclear where that is, when it is, what it consists of. They want to criminalize any failure to submit a voter registration form to the state within 10 days after it's signed. And also they want to assess heavy civil fines on those that submit 100 or more forms that are inaccurate. So if you collect the forms and they might be inaccurate, you risk the criminal penalty if you don't turn them in on time, but you also risk civil penalties for turning them in. The Republicans in Tennessee hold a massive majority in both houses, both chambers, excuse me, so it's very likely they will pass this bill. And they already have one of the lowest turnouts of any state. There is a case in Florida where they tried to do the a law rather in Florida where they tried to do this and it was overturned. So there will probably be a lawsuit, but it's quite truly unbelievable the extent to not get to suppress the vote. And you know who they're trying to suppress is minorities and people of color. Anyway, that's it. What do you got?
Probably elderly.
Yeah.
So, as I said, so being away, I was kind of teasing about the things that I learned about coconut water and things like that. But I would rather talk about Aperol. However, in glancing at some of the Mueller report stuff, I was struck by the quote, "This will be the end of my presidency. I am expletived." If you're innocent, would you say that?
No, I don't think, no, short answer, longer answer, don't think there'd be over 500 when everything's all unredacted pages saying you're innocent if you were just innocent.
Yes. Okay, so I want to get right to Antoine. He is the impassioned and extraordinary chef and president of Culinary Concepts, a 5-week boot camp that teaches life skills through the rigor of culinary training. He was trained at the Culinary Institute of America, some French cooking, I believe, and traveled the world from the Virgin Islands to Hawaii, California, probably elsewhere, and then to Charlottesville, lucky for us, as the executive chef at Common House. Welcome to the show, Antoine.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So 2 years ago, while you were an executive chef in San Francisco at, it looked like a resort, you were recruited to start the kitchen at Common House, which is a private social club here, which seems like an amazing opportunity, and from what I've seen, it looks like a really great place to work. And you've had an amazing career. What made you just decide to start your Culinary Concepts training program?
I would definitely say that, moving to Charlottesville, coming from San Francisco, I had this naive perspective that, oh, we're going to open a high-end club, and the doors are going to open, and, you know, everyone's going to apply for it, you know. What a great opportunity for a young culinarian. And to my surprise, when, you know, we posted our ad online, we couldn't find a soul. You know, we had our ad up for 2 weeks and no one applied. And, I had to humble myself and say, all right, you know what, maybe I'm not going to find the same cooks that I had in San Francisco. And, we posted an ad online and it pretty much said, are you passionate about cooking? Have you ever wanted to work in a professional kitchen? Send me your resume. And from there, the floodgates opened. You know, we received over 40 resumes. And what I learned from that experience was that in Charlottesville, you have a lot of people that are passionate about cooking, but they don't necessarily have the skills that we need in restaurants today. I went into that project with the greenest culinary team that I've ever had in my career. I remember Ben, shout out to Ben, one of the owners, coming in the kitchen in the very beginning. He was like, hey, dude, are you going to be okay? He was like, your team looks a little rough. And I'm like, no, I got it. We'll be fine. I taught them breakfast, lunch, dinner, you know, banquets, and, you know, we rolled. And for 6 months, I continued to post that same ad, and we averaged between, you know, again, 30 to 40 resumes a month. And that was the common denominator. You have people that have been in the industry for, you know, 4, 5 years, some longer, and they don't understand the investment needed in order to grow in this industry. So they're hopping around, you know, for 50 cents on the dollar. And, you know, they get to a point after 5 years of being in the industry and they're like, hey, you know what? I've decided that I want to be a sous chef. And they don't understand that, you know, 5 years on Pantry Station does not make you qualified to be a sous chef in any restaurant anywhere in the world. So there's just a disconnect with the educational aspect, and a disconnect with the life skills that's needed in order to be able to keep a job and grow with the job. So once I started to understand, my first question was, are there any programs out there designed to help people get a job? There's a lot of people out there that don't necessarily want to go to college. You know, you have PVCC, you have K-Tech. A lot of these individuals just need the training to get a job and start working right away. And once I discovered there were no programs out there, you know, my passion in my career has always been building teams and teaching people how to cook. So it was kind of a natural progression for me to create a curriculum and put something out there that would give people the opportunity to get jobs in restaurants.
We're going to come right back. We're going to go to a break with Antoine Brinson, the chef and owner of Culinary Concepts. Stick around. Welcome back, everyone. This is Apropos of Something. We air every Saturday morning live on 94.7 WPVC. We're sitting here with Don Gathers, who just spoke. You can catch that live interview on the website, 947WPVC.org, and also on Apple iTunes in a day or two. And then Antoine Brinson, chef and owner of Culinary Concepts. So the leading question I have for you is, tell us about the program.
Yeah, so the program is designed to, I realized there were three key areas that, you know, people didn't really understand about, you know, what food and beverage and cooking in general. The first was is hospitality. A lot of people don't realize that when you're cooking in a kitchen, you are in the hospitality industry. We serve people for a living. The second piece is the life skills. The life skills is the really the glue to the program to help people understand how to go from a I have a job to I have a career mentality. And then you have the technical training, which is the cooking part. I would definitely, again, say the life skills piece is the glue that holds this thing together.
And also, I have to say, Ellen, I have to say this.
Okay.
It's Culinary Concepts AB.
Thank you.
He's being too nice.
Thank you.
Well, thanks. You know, it's good to clarify because I just thought that that was the, like the LLC kind of thing, but it's it's AB. For Antoine.
Anyway, Antoine. Sorry?
I don't know. I was going to give you some accolades for always getting the details. Thank you.
I like it.
The one time. In the kitchen with these, you know, new people that want to get into some sort of culinary career, what's it like back there? What's the mentorship philosophy or vibe in there while they're all learning for the first time?
Well, and the program is it's 5 weeks, 5 days per week, 4.5 hours per day. It's equivalent to a part-time job. And my philosophy is if you can commit to a five-week program, a part-time job, then I can get to a full-time job. And that's kind of like the thing. But a lot of the class, you know, it's, again, 4.5 hours. The first 2 hours is classroom setting. You know, we spend the first hour going over hospitality training. And then the second hour, really just diving. I call it a deep dive, diving into different life skills. Each week is built off of a pillar. So the first week is integrity. Oh.
Okay.
Something happened.
Something happened. Did you hear that, Nancy? Okay, go ahead.
No, but I know something happened because you just told me.
Okay.
Is it this?
Things are vibrating.
Yeah. That's the
it's
vibe.
An exciting. It is the vibe. Yeah, go on.
Where did I leave off?
Oh, I was not paying attention.
First week, you're only in the first week.
Oh, yeah. So
there's four more weeks.
So it's four more weeks. Yeah. Second week is discipline. Oh, well, let's kind of dig into it. So, you know, the first week, integrity. And then each day of class, we talk about different forms of integrity. How does that relate in your everyday life? And how does that relate in the kitchen? And then everything we do in the kitchen, from the recipe, the design, the menu, to the recipes, it really focuses on helping people understand how integrity is displayed in the kitchen.
And you have 100% placement rate. Is that true?
99%. I had 99. One young lady that could not take a job due to she found out she was pregnant. So.
Well, I'm going to say that's 100%.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's fantastic. And I will boast that I was at the pop-up dinner in February. And really, it was an incredible experience. I know there's one coming up on the 27th, a week from today. If
yes.
people want to join, I think this is like the preliminary announcement for that.
Yes.
It fills up very fast, and they're for good, really good reason, because the food was better than, really, it was better than any restaurant I think I've had. And I think to do with the freshness of the ingredients, but the passion, I don't know about this part, but like the people that were cooking, we got to come back into the kitchen.
Yes.
And see, and they're very moving. People were interviewing, you know, for social and stuff. And it was very moving stories that I heard. So it was incredible. Can you tell us a story of transformation that you've witnessed?
Yeah, I would take it to the very first class. I had a young lady that, you know, we interviewed her. She just gave birth 2 weeks ago. And she was like, I've seen this opportunity, and I've always wanted to take a cooking class. I've always wanted to get into this industry. So she, you know, she came into this as a new mom, and she committed to the 5 weeks. And after she finished the program, she's like, Chef, what should I do next? And I'm like, well, you love this. You said you want to have a business. You should do an entrepreneurship program. So right after my program, she went ahead and enrolled in CIC, Community Collaborative Investment, which is an entrepreneurship program here in Charlottesville. And she rolled right into that and did the entrepreneurship program. You fast forward to now, she has a catering business in town, and she's up and running, and she still has her full-time job that she got after our program at UVA. She's living her dream. You know, I'm still mentoring her. I still talk to her. And she comes back to the class and talks to the new groups of students and tells her story. But it's just inspiring to see, someone's trajectory change because of an opportunity.
Antoine, who inspired you, especially in terms of this unique, well, it's not unique, but it's unusual, this approach to how you want to use your cooking, you know, the way you're doing all of this. Who inspired you, or what inspired you?
I would take it all the way back to growing up. I would say my mom was probably, is my biggest inspiration. Growing up, my mom was a foster parent for the majority of my life. And, you know, she spent her time, you know, living in her passion every single day. I got a chance to see her. You know, she raised over 250 kids. That's what she did. She didn't do it because it was a job. She did it because she loved doing it. And it wasn't until, you know, I would say later in my life that I understood why she did it, and I understood what it looked like to walk in your passion every day.
And in traveling the world, which Ellen alluded to at the beginning, do you have a favorite? You wound up in Charlottesville. I know the answer at the end of it, but did you have any favorite places that made an impact? I'm sure you did. So what were they?
I would say the two places that I love the most, I would say, is Dominica, the country, and Hawaii. I lived in Kauai for 4.5 years, and my second son was born there. That place is very special to me.
How did you wind up in Charlottesville?
when we're in San Francisco and you really look at, you know, I have two boys, my oldest son, my wife and I always said when he gets to middle school and high school, we wanted to plant our feet somewhere. We have been traveling for, you know, upward 15 years. And when I was looking for different places to go, I honestly thought I was going to end up in San Diego. But when we looked at Charlottesville, and one, it was a great job opportunity, but when you look at the community environment, when you look at the schools, when you look at the proximity to, you know, I'm from Buffalo, my wife is from New Hampshire, you know, on the East Coast, it was a great opportunity for us to plant our feet somewhere for the family. So this is, for us, it was really a family move.
And speaking of family, I know you are so incredibly busy. What are your keys to spending time with your family and making that life balance work?
Absolutely. I build it into my schedule. you know, I put family time just as high as, you know, this opportunity to be on the radio station, just as high as me being in the class with my students. I build that time into my schedule the exact same way. When I'm with my family, it's just as urgent as any other thing that I have on my schedule. So as by blocking that time off, you know, it's I'm focused when I'm there. I'm present.
Mm-hmm. That's a great tip.
In terms of what Ellen was saying earlier about experiencing your food at a pop-up, how difficult or what's involved with creating some sort of, you know, lasting impression or an ambiance, an environment at a pop-up? How do you do that?
Well, one, I mean, that's one thing that I've always done in my career. I love doing pop-up restaurants. but my thing with it was essentially the pop-up restaurant is a platform for the students to showcase all of the skills they've learned in the program, and a networking event for them to meet people in the community, to meet supporters, to meet chefs, to meet business owners. It's really a platform for them to start their journey.
Okay. I get it. I've wondered if... What's the biggest? What is the biggest actually pop up you've done? How big do they get?
No, like they're not that big. I mean, I don't take any. It's usually 40 people, 30 or 40 people. I like to keep it small and intimate, and really to try to one, the students aren't used. This is, I mean, like none of them have ever done anything like this, and two, you know, I really want the quality to be there in their work. I don't want this to become a thing about volume. It's all about quality.
It was. Just every dish was quality. How do you get them to do that, really? What is the secret? And tell us what the menu was, because it was so good.
Oh, God, I don't remember the
menu. Well, I remember the dessert was like this powdered sugar, waffly, amazing thing.
I don't
chicken salad, quinoa was in that salad.
Ellen can barely remember.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, tell us the keys to, like, really, it was really incredible. I mean, these kids, 5 weeks before this, they were not all kids.
Yeah.
Didn't really... know how to do very much, correct?
No, what I do is I break the menu down. So, you know, when you start with the first week, it's basic. The first week, we learn, you know, how to do, what is a banquet and what is a BEO and how do you execute a banquet? And I start with the basics, you know, how do you make a stock? How do you make a soup? You know, how do you make cold sauces? And then we roll into the second week. We go over sautéing, searing, braising, all the basic cooking techniques. And each week, I build on each skill and I break the menu down. So they're focusing on one aspect of the menu. It might just be the sauce. Another week, it might be the protein. And another week might be the starch, to make sure they understand the cooking techniques. And by week four, I put all of it together. So you go from making one piece of the dish to making the entire dish. And each student rotates on different dishes. So by this last week, for example, week four, everyone has pretty much worked on every dish on the menu. They understand every aspect of the menu. And they're no longer asking me questions. They're asking each other.
And what are the qualifications? I don't know if you had mentioned this, but what do you look for? So when a student applies or comes to you?
I need to know that this is what you want. You can't come to me saying, oh, I like cooking. This is not the program for you. This is for the people that are passionate about cooking. The passion is what makes this work. I mean, I'm really looking for most people, they have a conviction. For some people, it's their kids. For some people, it's a second chance. For other people, this is what I've always wanted to do. But it's that conviction within them that is going to keep them in the industry and help them, you know, navigate through their career.
And how do you know that someone's passionate about cooking?
Because I'm passionate. I can see it. You can see it in a person.
Mm-hmm. Are you taking Ellen with you?
I'm going to go. I'm going. Have I alluded to the fact that I've thought about doing this training?
No, you know, in the life skills piece during the week, I always invite like one to two guest speakers in. And it's an opportunity for, you know, people from the community to kind of share their passion. Because at the end of the day, it's all about building bridges for me.
Mm. Yeah, fantastic.
And what have restaurateurs said to you? The ones, you know, I'm sure your students, obviously, as you said, have been, you know, picked up by other places. So what have you heard from your from fellow restaurateurs?
So far, I mean, like, I'm averaging, honestly, like, I would say 3 to 4 restaurant inquiries a week now.
Wow. And tell us how many restaurants are in this Charlottesville area.
Over 500.
In this very small, a small town.
In a 10-mile radius, there's over 500 restaurants.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's such a transient industry with people and restaurants because of just because it's hard to find quality workers.
And what is it about cooking or cooks that they don't really understand what it takes, as you had said, and that makes it transient?
Well, I think it's really the dichotomy of the chefs being burnt out. You know, we work a lot of hours, long hours, and we can't find people. We'll go, you know, 2-3 months without having a body. And when you finally get someone in the kitchen, it's a day off. You know, you don't really have the energy, time, or mindset to invest in training that person the way you want to. So you just put that person on a station, you teach them what you need to, what they need to know, and you go into it with the mindset that this person's going to leave anyway. Mm. That's what happens. People just, you know, it's such a transient industry. And I think that it's that dichotomy where they're not making the investment. So people don't understand what they need to be able to keep a job. So they just leave and they hop around and they just don't, they're not connecting the dots.
And what are your next plans? What's up for you?
The next plans, I'm launching a second program, third quarter call. It's a leadership program. In this program, I work directly with chef restaurateurs. And the goal with this is to take their superstars or take the people that they see worth the investment and teach them how to be leaders in the industry.
Hmm. Interesting.
Do you use, or well, how much actually do you use social media to promote everything you do?
Everything, yeah, everything's on social media. It's kind of an open book.
Are you the one behind that? Or do you have a team?
Right now it's me. I'm working on bringing a team on, but right now it's me.
Do you use, what are your qualifications?
You need to love what I love.
Okay. I think I have someone for you.
Awesome.
We crossed the fourth dimension. And, you know, cooking, being an expert cook is not a small feat. Do you have any keys? Do you have any insight into how you've turned that into a successful business? Because I know one doesn't guarantee the other.
Right. I mean, you gotta believe in what you're doing. You can't just go out there and do it and say, hey, I want to make money. Like, my thing is about growing people. Like, I knew that if I invested in people and I invested in teaching them tangible skills that, you know, restaurateurs and people would want this service. Because I know we need it. As a chef, it was something that I would always hear everyone complaining about. I can't find quality people. But there were no opportunities for people to get the training. So for me, it was just one, really discovering what your niche is and believing in that and really just going for it. I mean, there's going to be some ups, there's going to be some downs, but you just got to stick to it.
I wanted to mention the couple key dates if you want to learn more firsthand about this whole experience that I recommend you do. So Saturday, 4/27 at the Space from 6 to 9 is the next pop-up. You got to get in early. Yeah, I got to go to culinaryconceptsab.com. Mm. And graduation, I heard, is an amazing event. It's going to be Friday, May 10th from 11 to 1 p.m. at City Space.
Mm, yes, yes.
Cool. Sounds good. Obviously.
Yes. So
thanks actually for spending some of your rare time. I don't even know if this was free time, but for creating some time for us.
Yes.
No worries. I leave here and go straight to a baseball game.
Oh, nice. That's great. Who's playing?
My youngest, he's playing softball.
Oh, that's great. Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. Yeah. Antoine Brinson, chef, owner, Culinary Concepts AB.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And
it's
I wanted to mention also an event coming up that Don made me aware of today, 4th Annual Easter Neighborhood Potluck.
Awesome.
It is 1 to 4 p.m. It involves food, so at least we have that theme. Is it Lugo McGinnis Academy? And there'll be Easter egg hunt, lots of stuff for the kids, face painting, stuff like that. So that's today. Today is April 20th.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much. Thanks, both of you guys, for being here. Stick around just for a few more minutes.
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Again, we'll do that social picture. So, Nancy, do you have a palate cleanser for us?
I do. Do I need music or do I just barge right in?
Oh.
I could just barge right in. It's staring me in the face.
Well, you know we love the music, right? And so
yes,
here it is.
Very right.
Almost. That was loud. The palate cleanser.
All right. Okay, forget paper or plastic. In honor of Antoine Brinson, the AB of Culinary Concepts, the choice is now wheat bran. There's a company in Poland named Biotrim. It's producing plates and bowls made from wheat bran that are actually edible. They're 100% biodegradable as well, which paper and plastic are not. And there's a guy named Jerzy Wozinski. That's his name.
I've heard of him.
In Poland, right, who's designed this production that doesn't require much water or mineral resources or chemical compounds. It's obviously very eco-friendly. And then, excuse me, there's this guy in India, Narayaba Pisapati, who's developed edible cutlery. Similarly, it's made of sorghum, rice, and wheat flour. Spoons and chopsticks don't get soggy. If placed in water or food, they're edible as well. They get softened by the time you're done, and you can eat them.
That's amazing. I know there's forks made of corn and utensils made of corn, but you can't eat them. So did you know about this, Antoine?
No, I didn't.
He didn't know about it?
No, I did not.
Make it week six. Come on.
All right. I like it. I'm always willing to try something new.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks for being here. This is Apropos of Something. Remember, no one has to do everything, but everyone has to do something. Our music is by Springtide, and we are very thankful for our new sponsors, Table 44 in Stanton, a great restaurant, and also the Moxie Hair Lounge. Everyone, we'll see you next week.